Main engine start.
I remember the day so clearly.
One liftoff.
Roger, roll, Challenger. Obviously a major malfunction.
I ran outside as fast as I could and I looked up in the sky.
Couldn't believe it. It exploded.
I'm science reporter Fiona Pepper.
And I'm Dr. Carl.
We're going to tell you the story of Challenger.
Challenger Legacy. Search for Science Friction wherever you get your podcasts.
Or on the ABC Listen app.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music and more.
There was this study done a while back that identified three main eras of Australia's universities. The first was the sandstone era, when those lovely grand universities were built close or in the city centres of our major cities. The universities that were mainly trying to look like Oxford or Cambridge. And that was at a time when such places were elite institutions that educated a small sliver of Australian society, mostly rich or academically gifted people. Following that, there was the post-war expansion under the Menzies and Whitlam governments, and then the new era, the one we're currently in, that started in the 1980s under the Hawke government, when the number of universities greatly expanded and universities began to host large numbers of overseas fee-paying students. Now, these reforms were hugely successful in so many ways. Higher education became a commonplace thing in Australia. It used to be a really big deal when someone in the family went to uni. It was in my family. But now it's almost expected. And today, the universities are just behind resource extraction as Australia's biggest export earner. But things have changed in recent years. Public trust in universities has slumped. Universities are increasingly criticised for becoming soulless corporations, paying their vice-chancellors huge salaries, while their students struggle with hunger and homelessness. And there are heated arguments over free speech and safety on what's left of campus life, which has gone from vibrant to stale. George Williams is back on Conversations today. George says that universities badly need a reset and to reclaim their lost social license and to make higher education more affordable. Now, as a kid, George Williams was a troublemaker, I've just discovered, from a low-income family, a kid who was on permanent detention. He was the boy least likely to go to university. But this Tearaway became a respected constitutional law academic, and now George is the vice-chancellor and president of Western Sydney University, and he's written an essay called Aiming Higher, Universities and Australia's Future. Welcome back, George.
Thank you.
What appealed to you about heading up a university in the outer burbs of Sydney, in Western Sydney?
I wanted to be at the coalface of education and opportunity, and Western Sydney is that coalface. It's a community that's the most diverse in Australia. It's where the big economic opportunities are. It's where we need to uplift people's sights. It's where we still have large numbers of people first in family to go to university. And at Western Sydney University, two-thirds of our students are still first in family. We've got the largest number of low SES students in the country from poorer backgrounds, the largest number of students who speak a language other than English at home. And I'm a big believer that if you want to change the world, you start with education. And for me, what better place to start where education is needed and where there's such hope and aspiration? So I just pinch myself every day. I feel so lucky to be in a place I can make a difference. And I'm in a place that really is the future of Australia, the sort of community we're going to become. And education is the ticket to get us there.
Now, you're the vice-chancellor, which is sort of like the CEO, even though that's kind of a slightly creepy term to use for a university chief executive, but you are that person. VCs have become increasingly criticised for claiming huge corporate salaries these days, huge corporate salaries, being paid much more than the Prime Minister, for example. What kind of a salary did they offer you and what did you accept, George?
Yeah, and as you imagine, this is one of the first conversations you have. And in my case, the conversation was along the lines of I wanted my salary benchmarked. I felt strongly that we're a public sector organisation. Let's find the right benchmark. And I had good support from my Chancellor, Jennifer Westacott. We looked across and found the right benchmark was to benchmark it to the federal public sector, to what a secretary of a department gets. And we picked the lowest, which is Veterans Affairs. And that's where we benchmarked it to. And I think that's the right approach. It should be defensible at arm's length. And I think it's also about restoring public trust. We're not there for the money. And in fact, I get paid very well, but it's got to be in line with something that's fair and public sector.
Was that less than what they initially offered you, though?
Well, we just jumped in early. And before we even got to that point, it was that let's find a way of actually working out that this is fair and right. So we did the work. So it was obviously a decrease, but it was one that I felt was consistent and one I felt, you know, matched what I wanted to see from the university.
Now in 2024, Western Sydney University opened a pantry on some of your campuses. What does that offer your students?
Food. You know, it's as simple as that, that we're not in the education business alone. We're in the food and education business. And I tell you what, my eyes were opened in talking to the students at the pantries, looking at the queues. Earlier this year, I turned up and we opened a new pantry in Parramatta, 80 people queuing up. And when I talk to those students, I realise that their daily struggles aren't just getting to the next tutorial, learning the lessons, but just survival. Poverty is real for Australian students, and these, by and large, are Australian students. And what they said to me is they said they just can't afford what could be the medicines, the textbooks, the transport, and the food. And too often they were going hungry, and we surveyed our students and found that one in two actually have food insecurity. And that was just a devastating and worrying statistic. It said a lot about us as a country that one in two Australian students can be struggling for food while they study.
What kind of food are you offering?
Just basics. So they can turn up at the pantry, and we thought we might get a couple of hundred people in the first few months. It was 3,500 visits we got. They turn up, they're allowed three staples. So it might
be rice or pasta or something?
Exactly. It might just be getting some oats, for example. It gives you a regular porridge in the morning. And also we give them some fresh fruit and veg. We've got some really good greenhouses, and if it's capsicum week, you might find hundreds of capsicums or cucumbers or whatever it is. But just the staples, Richard, just enough to get by, and it means that someone can actually turn up to campus having been fed as opposed to hungry. And, of course, as you will know, hunger and study don't mix. It's often why people drop out, just unable to meet the basics of living.
What kind of stories are you hearing from promising students who are in this queue?
I'm often hearing that everything was okay, but it was like on the line as to whether. And they might say something like, you know, I had an illness. I had to go to the chemist. My medicines were expensive. I couldn't afford the meal this morning. I'm here to pick up some food. Another person I talked to at one of our community dinners said they're living in their car and had been so for a couple of months. They said family couldn't put them up. Youth allowance is $47 a day for someone who lives out of home and by themselves. And median rents are $100 a day. And this student said they couldn't even find a couch to live on. So they're living in their car. And we got them some crisis accommodation. Other students are saying that the sums just don't add up. They live too far. They've got to pay for transport. Again, a common theme is family can't support them. Government assistance is too low. So for them, food's a lifeline. And it's the difference between staying in the studies and dropping out.
Is this a Western Sydney problem or is it endemic to other universities?
It's endemic around Australia. In fact, we've seen a similar survey in Tasmania, for example. In fact, almost exactly the same result. We had 50% of people food insecure, and of that, a good number, the worst form, which means regularly skipping meals. And what we're really describing is an endemic problem for young people in this country. It's a two-track system, Richard. I mean, my kids, to tell you the truth, are fine. The bank and mum and dad help them get through university. They can live at home. I can help support them. But if you don't have that, uni too often is poverty. And we have this big divide between the have and the have-nots. And the have-nots, the very people who most need social mobility in university, they're the ones who struggle most. And not surprisingly, including at my uni, high dropout rates. And not because of the studies, but the students just can't sustain this for 3 years to get through the struggle. And one thing often breaks them, health, family or the like. And I know, and speaking to others, this is a problem for young people around our country.
So that one thing, or two things, might force the student to quit their course, so they end up without a degree and with the student debt at the same time.
They do, and that's a big issue, and bitterness, I'd have to say. If you think of social cohesion, the best way of building a good, harmonious society, get people educated, give them a chance at a better life, get them through uni, whereas if they drop out, angry, bitter, with the big debt. And often what we find with those students is they feel as if society's against them. One thing young people will say to me is, you know, the social contract's broken. I thought this was a country of the fair go, where you study hard, you work hard, you put everything in it, and you'll be supported, and you go and make a good contribution. What they often say is it's broken. Doesn't work that way. And they feel as if society stacked against them. And not just food, I'd have to say. It's also devices is another big one. We've got around 40% of our students just with a mobile phone. And I talk to students who say, pretty tough writing a 3,000-word English essay on a mobile phone. But that again, is the reality of people who can't afford the devices, the food, and they're the staples of a university education.
When I went to university, I was the first one in my family to go to university. And like I said at the beginning, that was a real big deal in my family. You know, we've been in this country since the 1840s on my dad's side. Never much money, and certainly very little money in my family. So I could never have afforded to go to uni unless... But the tuition was free when I went there. It was right at the fag end of that. And there was a thing called TEAS back in those days, the Tertiary Education Assistance Scheme, which gave me a supplement. That allowed me to afford to go to uni. We don't have that same kind of level of anything like that level of support for students
now. No, at that level, we've got the Austudy. So that youth allowance, that gets you $47 a day if you're living out of home. But, and of course, maybe if you're in a regional area, it goes further. But gee, if you're living in Sydney, Melbourne, big cities, $47 a day, get yourself to and from uni, fed, as I indicated, rental accommodation, minimum $100 a day you're talking about, it just does not add up. And what the students do is they end up working incredible hours, and that's what's hollowing out some of the campus life. We've seen a doubling in the number of students from 1 in 14 to 1 in 7 who work full-time and study full-time. And you should only do one of those at the same time. And no wonder they end up really sometimes distressed, really exhausted, tired, because they're putting in phenomenal hours and they're not getting the full experience uni offers. They're rushing off campus back to a job, and sometimes campuses can look like fly-in, fly-out mining camps because the students are just so busy making ends meet.
And yet Australia is a much richer country now than it was when I went to uni, when you went to uni, much richer. And our universities are much richer. And students are living like that. Something seems to have gone horribly wrong here, George.
Well, I think our nation and indeed unis are built upon a model of student debt. That's the reality of it. And we've gone from a model of Whitlam, where of course it was free, through to Hawke, who introduced modest fees, which I support. You know, $1,800 they were, and today it's a $55,000 arts degree. And what we see is student debt peaked at $81 billion. You know, we're spending more time mining our students than the mining companies when it comes to where we get the money from. And essentially this amazing expansion, the democratisation of a university, it's a wonderful thing. It was designed and has worked out that it's on the back of student debt.
You mentioned there that we're mining our students rather than more than the resources sector. Tell me about this. You're quoting a figure there that was put forward at a lecture at the Australian Press, the National Press Club, by the director of the Australia Institute, Richard Dennis. Can you just go through that stat about how we fund our resource fossil fuel industry and how we fund higher education in Australia?
Well, if you look at the petroleum resource tax, it raises an amount, and if you look at what the students are taxed, it's five times that amount. So literally five times more each year.
We tax students, university students or higher education students, five times as much?
Yes, that's right. And that's what that data shows, and shows the prioritisation of Australia, that essentially we hit our students harder. And again, this is part of a pattern in this country. It could be negative gearing, you name it. We have a set of policy settings that are really geared against young people getting ahead. And uni's just part of that. There are so many of these things. Find a house, get into the market, very difficult, stacked against young people. And it's no surprise when you look at that, when you look at the surveys of young people, that nearly two-thirds say they have a sense they don't belong in this country. The country doesn't support them. Compare that to over 70s, it's about 80% who say they feel they belong here. There's a intergenerational problem that starts with education, but you see that throughout the tax system, the housing. And again, you care about social cohesion, you should look after young people, get them into good jobs and be productive members of society.
Now, you come from a low-income background as well, and your parents, though, were the first in their families to go to uni. What was your father's experience of university like back in the day, George?
So, I mean, my parents both grew up in Tasmania. My dad came from Queenstown, a mining town, again, first in family. He had to leave school, actually had to leave Queenstown at 15 to go to Hobart, live in a boarding school by himself to complete his high school, then went to the University of Tasmania. My mum was from Hobart, met at uni, had me when mum was 19, so very young. But for them, university was that game changer. It was the moment that suddenly their life's journey was shifted. And they left Tasmania at a young age. I was about four, moved to Sydney. Dad became an academic at the University of New South Wales, but his experience was not a happy one. Look, I think you describe his politics as not just left, but far left, in a Marxism. He loved the union movement, strikes were his bread and butter, and he only lasted in the university sector for 3 years before his contract was not renewed. And he was very bitter on the back of that, felt he'd been let down. The uni sector had deserted him. And throughout his life, he died a few decades ago, he would describe university management in particular as being evil.
Evil.
The ones who kicked him out. And so it's pretty poignant for me. Here I am in university management. But yes, he would rail against the vice chancellors, the deputy vice chancellors, those people who'd ruined the university sector. And we're talking his 70s when he felt it was ruined. And so his experience was a very negative one, despite his love for education and universities. And I never thought I would ever work in a university as a result. So it's, you know, sometimes life takes you on a strange journey.
What kind of work did he go into after he left academia?
He spent a lot of time in manual work, foundries, other places. You'd have to say his work, though, were workers, you know, organising the strikes, getting better conditions, public sector. But he was an economic historian who loved ideas, loved history. And he did spend a short time in a CIE up in Brisbane, in Toowoomba, actually. But, you know, never really lived out his aspirations to be someone within a university sector.
Now, let's talk about you as a student, George, because I don't know, I'd always imagined you, particularly, you know, as a really, I would have imagined you to have been this really driven academic kid, constant, that kid who's constantly working when the other kids are out playing. That wasn't you at all, was it?
No. Gee, when I was in primary school, I would have taken bets that the teacher sat in the classroom saying, in the area saying, who's going to have this kid? You know, please no, I do not want him in like my class.
If I have George in my class, you have to have a crap kid as well.
You've got to take three crap kids. That's the way it would have been. In terms of the ratio, I was just a kid who didn't see the value of education. And my parents had split up when my dad lost his job. It was a difficult time. Lived with my mum. She was often working in a fruit store, other places. And it was a really difficult time, and I went off the rails. I used to spend my free time, old disused factories, smashing windows, melting lead and things like that. So
melting lead?
Melting lead. So I used to go to the factory, pull out the lead sheeting from the windows. I talked to a shop nearby where they had you know, metals and leads, and they said, yeah, bring it to us and we'll buy it from you. And what I actually did was I melted it down over a campfire using a brick, poured it into the brick, and got these ingots of lead that I'd sell.
At what age are you doing this?
Eight, nine. And, you know, on one occasion I nearly killed myself because I was a bit impatient for the lead to... I wanted to sell it. It was still molten. It was bubbling in the brick, in the ingot, and I poured a bucket of cold water on it, and it exploded. Literally exploded in my face, lost my eyebrows, lost my skin, and I was so lucky that I didn't kill myself or lose my sight. But that was eight, nine, delinquent, you'd have to say, and, you know, a kid who school just didn't matter much at that age.
You said your parents had split and your mum was working in a fruit shop. Was she around, or did she need to be at work the whole time? And were you kind of left to your own devices at this time?
Well, whenever she could be, but, you know, a latchkey kid for a lot of the time. You get home from school, head over to the factory, whatever you might do. And, you know, my mum had also gone to uni, had a love of learning, and, you know, she bought me books, all sorts of things, tried to get me into Shakespeare, never stuck, I'd have to say. Sci-fi and fantasy were the thing I grew to love. But, you know, it's tough being a mum with a couple of kids, growing up in a situation where you got no family support. They're back in Tasmania or in Sydney at this point. And, at that point, I don't know what future I saw for myself. Probably didn't think of it, except you go off the rails and you're on a very, very different path to where I ended up.
She had political activities like your dad. How did she get you involved in those political activities, George?
Yeah, both very political. And my mum, I do remember actually when I was learning to write, she used to do a lot of volunteer work for Amnesty International. And back then, there's no internet, so you can't send an email. It was literally writing letters to foreign governments to release political prisoners. So I can remember we'd write to the South African government, please release Nelson Mandela, or whoever it might have been in Pakistan or whatever country. And I remember writing those with her where she would say, yeah, let's practice your letters. And that's how I would do it with my mum.
Oh, right. So you're writing these kiddie letters.
Yeah, that's right. Amnesty would give you the text often to write to free the political prisoner. And my mum would volunteer, write 20 of them, and she'd get me to do it with them, writing these letters out. And I have memories of Amnesty helping me do my letters and learning to read and write.
So you're this young kid who's getting into trouble. You're melting down bits of stolen lead into ingots at the age of 9. And you're also writing letters to the president of South Africa asking Nelson Mandela to be freed. What kind of future did you imagine for yourself? I'm guessing you weren't imagining an academic future at all.
Oh, look, if you'd asked me about, and this is absolutely right for the age, you have to say, if somebody had said you're going to be a vice chancellor, I'd say that's a Star Wars figure. Would you, Chancellor Palpatine, you're talking about? That would have been as close as I get with Star
Wipe
Wars.
Wipe them all out. Yes.
Absolutely. And yes. Of course, I was big on Star Wars at that age, still am, but no way. I didn't think of university, didn't even think of education. And look, Richard, a key turning point in my life was year 5 of primary school, off the rails, and I was just getting detentions all the time. The teachers had called me in for all sorts of things, you know, wrecking school photos. I remember putting my thumbs up in the middle of a school photo just as I was taking it, getting no digital. Everyone in that year got me with my thumbs up in the middle of the got called into the principal's office for that. But I remember my year 5 teacher at Lane Cove Primary School, and she said, look, George, this isn't working. You're getting in detention all the time. Let's just make it permanent. Let's not kid around here. Every Thursday lunchtime, you've got a detention. And I thought that was pretty unfair, to tell you the truth. I hadn't even done anything yet. And maybe it was my legal instincts coming out early. Where's due process in this? But what I discovered was the Thursday lunchtime detention was just me and her. And it was a turning point because she sat me down and said, I'm going to work through the material with you. And every lunchtime, every Thursday lunchtime, spend an hour. And she sat with me. And that was the moment where I actually thought, actually, someone's investing in me, apart from my family. Someone thinks I can be something. Someone sees something. A moment of self-esteem. And at that moment, I started to actually enjoy the learning. And that was a turning point. One teacher investing in me that shaped my life. And that was one of a few teachers and things that put me on an entirely different trajectory that I had been on previously.
Did you realise what she'd done for you at the time, or is that on reflection that she'd
absolutely
changed your
reflection.
Whole life?
Absolutely on reflection. I didn't see it at all. Of course, it's at that age, it's just, what am I here for? But it's a gradual thing over the course of, you know, in this case, months. But, you know, my life is shaped by education and great teachers. And it's when I look back, I see that was a pivotal moment in my life where a teacher stepped up, saw something in me and gave her time every Thursday lunchtime for the rest of the year. And, you know, I give great credit to public school education and that teacher for where I am today.
So what put you on the path to law, George? Of like the outlaw goes to do law. What put you on that path?
Yeah, the path for me was that, you know, I went through primary school, really difficult. Things started to come together in high school. My mum remarried, a more settled environment. And that primary end of primary school said, actually, you can make something of yourself. And I remember being in commerce in year 9 in St. Ives High School at this point, another great public school. And we were studying the Tasmanian Dam case from 1983, and it was on the news. The Hawke government had passed laws to stop the damming of this beautiful river. I'd come from Tasmania, of course, the Franklin River, and that's near where a lot of my relatives lived. I'd have to say a lot of them wanted to see it dammed, but I looked at the High Court case, which decided, could the federal government intervene? Could it stop the dam? And I was just taken by it. I thought, this is actually using the law to social ends, to environmental protection. And I thought, I'd like to be part of that. I thought, this is powerful and interesting, and you can shape something good and important.
So you applied for uni. Where did you get in?
I applied for Sydney Uni, missed out by one mark. But to my delight and a great education, got into Macquarie Law School, where I studied there for the 5 years and had great teachers. The recently deceased Tony Blackshield, one of my most important mentors, the singing professor he was. He would actually sing in class. He taught me constitutional law. And again, another key moment in my life, inspiring teacher, wonderful person. And that's when it crystallised. I say, that's what I want to do. That's the area that I want to spend a good part of my profession in.
You didn't want to do corporate law, which is where people typically make the most
God,
money
no.
out of law.
No, please no. I mean, I did work as a solicitor for a couple of years, but no, I've always been interested in how do we build a great society? It's my background, I think, Richard. My life was changed by education, good systems, and I've always been motivated to think everyone deserves the same chance. How do we build a society around equal opportunity?
So after graduation, 1992, you went to work for a High Court judge in Canberra. That was the year of the Mabo case, wasn't it? George, were you involved in that?
I was, and gee, I was lucky. And look, I was, that was the year to be a High Court Associate. And we're talking these young people straight out of uni. You know, a couple of weeks after finishing uni, I'm travelling down to Canberra to work at the High Court as the assistant to Justice Michael McHugh. You do the research, you sit behind them in court, carry their books, and you're at the the front end of the big decisions when it comes to the judiciary. And one of the first ones I got to work on was the Mabo case, checking the footnotes, doing some of the research. And I well remember going down with the judges in the lift for that case to be delivered. And for me, I have very vivid memories of the Indigenous people in the audience and what a massive win it was for them and how important it was. And to be part of that at age, 23, it was just a pinch me moment.
Did the significance of it strike you at the time, or did it take a while for the significance to strike you? Because on the face of it, it's a gardener working at the University of James Cook Uni,
yes,
wasn't he?
That's
Eddie
right.
Mabo, he's from the Torres Strait, always assumed that his traditional land was his land. And the significance of that case meant that the legal fiction of terra nullius, the idea that Australia was uninhabited by human beings before the arrival of Europeans, was done away with. Was there a kind of a growing awareness of the significance and the impact of that High Court decision as it went along?
Not at the time, no. It was obviously a significant case, but it was, you know, on the Torres Strait, it was not clear it would apply to the mainland. It could have easily been an important case, but not the nationwide changing case that it was. And for that, you got to add in Paul Keating. It was actually only many months later when Paul Keating introduced the Native Title Amendment legislation to actually introduce Commonwealth government-supported Native Title. That was the game-changing moment. That transformed a judicial decision into a nationwide change, and that's really where it became clear Mabo was a big thing. But without Keating's intervention, it may not have achieved what it did.
So this is when you really do see the law as having an ability to change the whole nature of a country to help live in truth in this case.
Yeah, it's a catalyst. In this case, it was a catalyst for Indigenous justice, Indigenous rights, but also demonstrated rely just on the courts at your peril. You need politicians, you need parliament, and it's a system that brings in all the arms of government to actually effect true, lasting change. And that's what Mabo was about. Keating almost forming a partnership with the High Court judges, of course, not directly because they're independent, but the bringing together of those arms of government, they were the things that actually meant that Mabo stuck and why it arguably is the most important case handed down by the High Court.
In some ways, you say you see your booklet as a handbook really for young people to actually take on the system and demand change. You say you've been listening to young people. How do you listen to young people in these matters, George?
Well, I'd have to say, Richard, it started off with failure. I arrived with the best hopes of connecting with young people. And, you know, we've got 50,000 students. It's a big number to connect with. I set up a Zoom webinar with me, and 25 turned up. Look, I'd have to say gold medal for the ones that turned up. I mean, how dreary is that, a Zoom webinar with the Vice-Chancellor? But I talked to my social media team, young people, and they said, you're just in the wrong place. You've got to go to where young people are. So, of course, it's social media. So we segued to social media, set up a TikTok live session, Instagram live session, got over 1,000. And not only that, they were raw. They were passionate about talking about food, housing, and the other issues. And I learned a good lesson from that, that partly you've got to go where people are, even though it's out of my comfort zone. I've had many micro-humiliations since.
Oh, like what?
Oh, look, on one, the students actually bet me would I do a headstand. If they got 10,000 likes, I turned to my team and they said, no way. Are they going to get it? You're safe. But then, of course, they all loaded on to social media. They got the 10,000 likes and I was stuck doing a headstand for the students. They've had me doing what I know, if you're on TikTok, you can't be too boring. I've got to have dancers behind me because I'm a bit dull apparently sometimes. All sorts of things. But it works. And when I walk around our campuses, what I often find is the students will come up and they'll say, hey, you're that guy from TikTok. And I'll say, yeah. And then they'll say, what do you do here? And like I say, I'm Vice Chancellor, and say, what's that? Is it the Star Wars character, whatever it is? But then it opens a conversation. We have a chat about food, housing, whatever it is. And I'd have to also say it's had a really unexpected and positive benefit at home too. And that is that when my 15-year-old daughter discovered I was on TikTok, she said, that's it, I'm off. If you're on TikTok, I'm not going on that medium. And she banned herself from social media. She said, Dad, you're lame and a tryhard. I'd say to Albanese, you don't need to ban social media. Just get parents on it. It was very effective. My daughter's back on it again, unfortunately. I've been trolling her by going on her favourite social media feeds in the hope she gets off them.
Very wise, very wise. You aim a really high charge at higher education, at the university system in your booklet here. You say that universities have fallen into a position where their social license is in question, like the space that the public at large, the goodwill that the public at large has for universities has slumped that badly. What are the signs of this slump in public goodwill towards universities?
Well, I think we're the banking sector of the current day. And if you ask where we stand and look at the number of inquiries, one in New South Wales, Victoria, we had a couple of federal ones last year, we've got a Royal Commission, which will cover us as well, and that's just scratching the surface. When you see the sort of political reaction, it speaks of a community concern. Other polling shows that we've reached the level where most Australians no longer have a positive view of the university. That's a big thing. Most Australians don't think positively about the universities anymore. And we're the body that everyone should think well of. We're the ones that educate, that create the good societies, provide opportunity. And my view is that that's not just a PR issue. This is an issue of substance. This is something we must address. And we must address the fundamentals. And indeed, one of the reasons I wrote this book is understand, how do we get here? How do we get to this point where people have lost faith too often in the universities? And more importantly, what are we going to do about it to make sure that good democracies depend upon good universities? And that's where we need to be.
Talking to young university students myself, as I do, they see themselves as these people who are kind of tolerated in the corporation that is the modern university, this vestigial thing that's a legacy thing, if you like, that goes back to their historic mission to, yeah, we better educate some of our students in this larger corporation that's really about earning money, that's become a corporate entity to afford these salaries they're paying the Vice-Chancellor, this huge managerial structure that sits on top of universities and turns so much of academic life, talking to academics, to box-ticking exercises, over-regulation, all that sort of thing. That kind of freewheeling nature of campus life has disappeared under the corporate nature of universities. Is that something you see as well, George?
I do. I actually have some sympathy for that view. And of course, you've got to be careful to generalise too much. Yeah. There's wonderful examples, there's problematic examples. But if we talk at the sector level, we have a system that bears out the design that was put in place in the 1980s. This was not by drifting into it. This was by intent. Back in the 80s, you had the Dawkins reforms, and the Hawke government wanted to do the good thing of democratising higher education, opening it up to all, a good thing, a fair go for everyone. But they didn't want to pay for it. And so what they did is they designed a system where they opened up education but said, firstly, to students, you've got to pay your fair share. And it was your fair share in the 80s, but it's now exploded and got very high. Universities also had to attract vast numbers of international students to pay the bills. And if you look at the figures, back in the 80s, about 80% of uni revenue came from government. Now it's 40%. So it's halved the percentage from government, but the number of students has tripled to 1.6 million. So in terms of the budget, in terms of the treasury, triple the students, half the investment, it has absolutely worked from a Commonwealth perspective. But what's the cost? Well, the cost is corporatisation, focus on making a buck, because unis are so cash-strapped a lot of the time that if they don't focus on the bottom line, that they literally, I mean, many are just in deficit. And the ones who get squeezed the most are Australian students for fees and services.
Universities are really focused on shooting up the rankings. Of universities. And Australia's universities have done quite well in that, haven't they? They've sort of managed to encroach upon the top ranked universities in the world. But has that happened at the expense of some of its core activities, the need to pursue those rankings?
Oh, I think so. And again, this is the dynamic that drives many universities. It's that, I mean, to balance the books, fund your research, you need international students. I mean, they can pay triple or even more what an Australian student pays. And remember that the government doesn't even pay enough a lot of the time to cover the cost of an Australian student. So you've got to cross-subsidise. And even at Western Sydney Uni, we don't have many international students compared to others, but roughly 24 cents in every dollar from an international student supports food, devices, support for domestic students. So you need to get international students. What gets international students in? Rankings. What drives rankings? Research. So you've got this cycle that involves more international students, get the rankings, research. That's what drives the engine room of many modern universities. And it's important that domestic students don't get a look in to that. They don't provide the money to pay the bills. So our universities are really outwardly focused. And yeah, if you look at the international rankings, if there was an Olympics for universities, we'd win. We've got 9 in the top 100, better than any country in the world per capita. In fact, if you look at any that have got 9, you turn to the US and the UK and us, that's it, and compare their size and their dollars. So Our unis have absolutely thrived internationally. We have done what they were meant to do. No country has been more successful. But again, it's been at the cost, I think, of domestic students and them being at the forefront of the system.
Those rankings are heavily dependent on research, aren't they? The amount of research that a university is undertaking. Again, does that direct funds towards research, which is a fine and good thing, but away from the business, the core business of teaching undergraduates?
Well, I mean, undergrads just don't get a look in any meaningful way in those international rankings. So you look at other surveys which ask, are Australian students leaving university satisfied? And about one in four are not. Way too high and unacceptable, but that doesn't affect the international ranking. So you can actually have a problematic domestic experience and still shoot up the rankings. And you can also have problems we've seen where you have very large numbers of international students with small numbers of domestic students in a class, issues where you just got the balance wrong. And it's terrible for the international students who are so privileged to have a study here that they've come for an Australian experience and then just studying sometimes with people from their home country. And they do wonder, why have I come here? I could easily be with, for example, Chinese students in Beijing. But we have some structural problems that reflect the way the sector was set up. And if we want to fix that, you've got to go back to those fundamentals. What are we here for? What do we deliver? What do we prioritise? And that requires government support and intervention.
One of the big themes of those Dawkins reforms in the 1980s was to improve vocational education, to have that improve that direct link between what you're studying at university and the job that it would qualify you for. And this has meant the humanities have sometimes gotten in the way of that, because the whole philosophy behind doing an arts degree, for example, is not to be so vocationally directed necessarily, but to produce a better citizen, to produce the kind of citizens that can think more critically, to engage with things, to have a richer life that can contribute to the public space. I mean, I'm going to say this because I'm an arts grad myself, but has that fallen foul, the whole idea of the humanities and an arts degree in this, do STEM at high school, do a STEM-related course at university and go into this, that or the other thing, George?
Or do a really specific business degree in marketing. But yeah, that's where unis have been pushed to focus on the job at the end of the degree. And of course, the problem is that these days people might have five or six different jobs during their working life. And it's even more apparent today with the rise of AI that what we really need are generalists. We need critical thinkers. I'd actually say Australia needs more historians, philosophers, comedians, you name it. We need people who can interpret this world and help think differently. AI is too good at doing those basic vocational things. So we've got to add the human skills. And for me, it's never been a more important time to do the humble arts degree. Because it is the degree that prepares you for whatever comes next. And in running a university, my biggest challenge is to prepare students for jobs that don't even exist yet. And that requires resilience, diversity, critical thinking. And again, your arts degree is the ticket, in my view.
The last year of the Morrison government, 2021, they introduced a new system, which they called Job Ready Graduates Package. That was the package they put, which meant effectively, famously, it was said at the time that they were putting in place $50,000 arts degrees. How's that panned out for the universities? Has it done what they'd said they'd hoped it would do, this new job-ready graduates package?
Well, let me focus even more on the students. It's been a disaster. I mean, it's as simple as that. I'd put this in my top five worst public policy mistakes of the last couple of decades made by Australian governments. So they put in a system that said, we'll remove any link between earnings on graduate and what we charge you when you go to uni. So we're now at the $55,000 arts degree.
Oh, dear.
Despite that, it's the most expensive degree in the country, despite arts graduates earning on average the least amount compared to other degrees.
More than law and medicine?
It's on par with law and business.
Right.
So you can do your law degree, go to a big firm. So arts is up there. There's a top tier and it's there. And what happens is that many people do the degree and they'll never pay it off, ever. And of course, that affects their ability to get a housing loan down the track. And if you look at who actually does the arts degree, it is the degree of choice of first in family, low SES, Indigenous students. So we're suddenly making the pathway into higher education the most expensive for the students who most need it. And no surprise, the idea was that let's tell people an arts degree is too expensive, don't do it. The idea of the Morrison government is they'll swap into something else. So $55,000 for arts, $14,000 for maths. So let's swap between arts and maths. But guess what? People don't do it. A philosopher doesn't decide to become a mathematician. So it's absolutely failed in misunderstanding student choice, except the choice not to go to uni.
The Albanese government came into office 4 years ago promising to do something about this package. Have they done anything about it?
No, no, and it's about time they did. For me, this is the number one most urgent thing in the sector, fair fees for students, particularly students who want to leg up through higher education. The promises are there. We're going to have a new body called the Australian Tertiary Education Commission, ATEC, which will look at this. But look, everyone is in furious agreement. It is broken. The government's made it clear. It's just urgent. And every day we wait is a day students are paying too high fees or students are missing out on university. And I just like to put this at the front of the pile. The government did, to its credit, reduce the debt, the student debt, by 20% coming into the last election. Big positive change, saved people thousands of dollars. But of course, the biggest impact were for people doing law, MBAs, things like that, who arts or people often did make a difference because they wouldn't pay it off anyway. And that policy did nothing for new students. I mean, the fees are too high. And it's a bit like saying we've got a housing affordability crisis, give everyone 20% off their mortgage, but doesn't do a thing for people who can't get into the market. We've got to address the fees up front.
Recent guest on this program had worked as a police hostage negotiator for years and years and years through injury, eventually had to leave the police force, went into academia. And he told me he feels like he's walking on eggshells the whole time in academia at the moment. This is a former police hostage negotiator who finds it a more awkward place to be in academia. And he's speaking more quite generally there. Has there been a loss of social license in the humanities? Has the a poisonous atmosphere has sort of gone through the humanities in recent years? The language policing, the smothering of debates, a demand for safe spaces for me but not for you, that kind of culture in the humanities, the tone of the humanities? Is this why the humanities have become an easy target for the governments and the like?
Well, in a world of culture wars, it's no surprise the humanities are very much in the frame. But of course, we need them more than ever because in a world of misinformation, lies, interpreting where we're going, you actually need those creative thinkers. You need people who can look at history and ask, well, based upon that, where do we head in the future? But also, Sir Richard, there's an additional one that it's not just humanities, it's job insecurity as well throughout the sector. When you have up to 60% of all teaching done by casual staff who, you know, these are people who they've told me they wonder whether they can start a family. Will they have a job next term? Can they buy a house? The endemic job insecurity is absolutely corrosive of good lives for these people. And one of the proudest things I've got at Western Sydney, which my predecessor, Barney Glover, brought in, was actually a decasualisation program, converting 160 people in partnership with the NTU, our union, converting these people to ongoing secure jobs. And because insecurity just breeds, it just erodes what's important in any workplace.
George Williams is here. George is the Vice Chancellor of Western Sydney University. He's written a booklet called Aiming Higher, Universities and Australia's Future. It sort of reminds me about that old joke that used to be said. Why are the rivalry between poets so vicious and personal and nasty? And the answer is because there's so little at stake.
Yes.
I wonder if that's the kind of phenomenon you're talking about here, George.
Well, one of the problems with unis is when you have, you know, declining resources, you're fighting sometimes over what you got left. And in a growth environment, it's much easier. You know, you grow, you expand, there's opportunities. But when you look at last year, you know, it's been calculated up to 3,500 jobs lost from universities in Australia. The UK, it's closer to 20,000. Canada jobs are being lost. So when jobs are being lost, these are lives and careers being destroyed. It's no wonder there's a level of fear, a level of distress. And at my university, I spent a lot of time speaking to people. And we had a really tough time last year ourselves with job loss. Just for the basics, you couldn't make the budget balance, which you've got to do. You've got to make sure you've got enough to pay the salaries. But this year, it's much more of a focus on moving forward positively. And that's my job, is to create an environment people can enjoy their jobs and thrive.
Universities have been fiercely criticised, and this is even before the Bondi massacre, for their handling of anti-Semitism on campus. Are universities really struggling to find some space between critical thinking, proper robust debate, passionate disagreement, all that sort of thing on the one hand, and hate speech on the other?
And we are. Let me say firstly, if we're not being criticised, we're not doing something right. You know, we are the place, it's got to be the place of uncomfortable ideas. We've got to be the place where people are testing things that challenge assumptions, that really make people sit up and think. And so that's our business. If we're in the easy thinking, we're not doing the right thing. But when it comes to these areas, I mean, these are very difficult. I mean, I've been a free speech scholar. I know how hard it is. You've got lengthy court cases trying to draw lines. And I'd just say for me, I think all I can do as administrator is make sure there's space for speech, protest, but also sometimes you've got to draw very clear lines. And when it comes to protecting the safety of students and community, you just got to have a zero tolerance for hate speech.
Call me crazy. You mentioned AI here, but call me crazy, George. It seems to me that generative AI must force universities to make everything old and new again, to go back to the old school, face-to-face, small tutorials, no technology in the room, just conversation and oral examination. What do you think, George?
Well, even pen and paper people are turning back to.
Yeah.
And you know, to the extent there is some positive out of this, you're going back to the humble tutorial. I mean, there's no better model for community building, social cohesion, get your Jewish student, your Muslim student, your other students, understanding, work together, form friendships. It's a real bedrock of friendships and good society. But I think we do a bit too much of that. I actually think we often put our head in the sand, and the best unis are saying, no, a bit of that, but also let's embrace the opportunities. For me, with AI, 50,000 students, can I personalise learning down to the individual student? Can I get them a tutor if they're struggling with numeracy or literacy in a way you can't do at scale? We're looking at developing an app that will give them personalised support. And also, of course, there's brand new jobs and opportunities. This is really exciting and good if we get it right. But assessment's got to fundamentally change, because I tested it the other day, put in my Ask ChatGPT, developed me a constitutional law essay, did so instantly. Good essay, Bill of Rights, second year students. I said, give us an answer. Gave me a great answer. I said, mark your own answer. And it gave itself an HD. And I tell you what, I would have given it an HD. So there, really? In literally 5 minutes, wrote the assessment, answered the assessment, marked it. We've got to change and recognise what are the human factors we're bringing to this, because if we don't, and we are seeing students who are saying, I'm worried I'm not learning anything because I can just get these generative systems to do the work for me.
What do governments need to do?
I think the Australian government could certainly do more to put Australia at the forefront of AI development in a really ethical way. But I speak less about government, frankly, more about unis. We should be leading this. We should be leading the ethical, appropriate adoption of AI. Australia should be a powerhouse, and it should be human-centred AI. I don't see it as replacing jobs. I see it as enhancing jobs to help our people develop the skills, do exciting things they couldn't do. And I'm a big believer that this technology used well will be a better society and actually a community where we have higher living standards. But you've got to deal with misinformation and the evils that undoubtedly also go with this technology.
Well, speaking more generally, though, what do governments and universities need to do beyond AI?
Well, I think if you take AI out of the equation, I mean, my number one is start with a fair go for students. I think the number one thing the sector needs is get rid of job-ready graduates, the $50,000, $55,000 arts degree, and just charge students fair fees for the course. Beyond that, I'd also like to see some fundamentals change. We do need a conversation, particularly about closer connections between our TAFEs, our vocational education and uni. Too many barriers flipping between the two, and it should be seamless. I think also we need to have a real focus on equity students. And I'd also say a good part of this actually isn't universities at all. The biggest crisis I see often is just in high schools, where we're seeing dropping rates of completion in year 12. And across the nation, the federal ministers raised this. We went from 83% completion rates in high school over the last few years to 73%, 10% drop in students finishing high school.
Did you just say there's a 10% drop in students finishing high school?
Yes.
Over how long a period?
It's about 7 or 8 years.
7 or 8 years.
Yeah.
Is that something to do with COVID, possibly?
No, it was before then. And in fact, we still see it. So 1 in 10 students who finished high school previously now don't. In Australia, we see it in the rankings, and it's magnified particularly in boys. And if you look at places like Queensland, Tasmania, other places, less than 1 in 5 boys now will get a tertiary education. A girl's much, much higher. The girls get it, but the boys in big numbers are not going to university, and we're setting ourselves up for a big social problem where they don't have the skills in a decade or more to get good jobs and well-paid jobs.
Is there something about the culture of universities that makes boys, well, encourages boys, well, the courage, the culture in Australia, that where boys coming out of high school look at university and go, that's definitely not for me?
I think it's a job market in part. There are jobs there, you know, good earnings, but they're deferring high-paid earnings and better long-term jobs for the quick buck. And it's why I think we need to look in universities and with government degree apprenticeships, get them studying and earning from day one. There's models that actually work for this. But also, I think we're in a society where girls are outperforming boys in many, many areas, including just in high school. They're the ones winning their prizes more often. And so you look across the sector, it's about 62% of all students are female, 38% male. That's a dramatic difference. And it's actually widening, not decreasing. So for me, if we talk equity, I'm often talking young men and boys these days. The girls get it much more often than the boys do.
Since I've graduated, George, I've looked on in growing horror as one by one the university bars have closed down, which is in itself is one thing, but it seems to be symptomatic of a larger problem with campus life. Students are attending lectures virtually. Are there fewer people on campus? Is that whole joyful, fizzy pleasure of what used to be campus life sort of dissipated? Is there not the critical mass of students around anymore?
Yeah, that is often a problem. And again, different unis, different issues, but the absence of campus life for students is a big problem. I'd also say a part of it is the students themselves are struggling to make connections. And I talked about earlier food, devices, but loneliness is one of the biggest challenges we face. We actually have volunteers who connect students on orientation day, you know, make a friend. And it's partly our students arrive immersed in their devices and online worlds and then struggle to actually connect with another human being and feel really shy. And so when you don't have the vibrant campus life, when you have a difficulty of connecting for students, you're setting people up to miss the networks, the friendships that they need to form. But yeah, I'd love to see, you know, students more able just to have those lazy times, you know, just the down times. That's where people form their identities, their friendships and the like, and there's much less of that than there should be.
Again, I'm speaking anecdotally here, but increasingly talking to young people and my kids and around, there's a growing awareness that their phones are bad for them. I just noticed this. I've really noticed in the last 4 or 5 years or so, my phone is something I have to wean myself off. I wonder if universities need to take a stronger stand against those devices. Like, this is not a place for your phone. This is not a time for your phone. Your phone is like, I don't know, crack cocaine. Put it aside or leave it at home when you come to uni.
We've got the social media ban. Maybe you need a phone ban, Richard. There we go. Public policy being made.
I know, that's not realistic. I mean, we can't treat them like high school students.
They get it. Yes. They know they've got an addictive product that's often bad for them, and they struggle with that. But again, it's designed to be addictive. It's highly effective. And not only is it addictive, it's essential. You can't connect with your friends without it. That's the way social communities are being formed in high school and beyond. And as I've indicated, in our case, about 40% of our students only have a mobile phone for their studies. So without the phone, they don't have a laptop. How do they take their notes? How do they write their essays?
Pen and paper, George. Pen and paper?
Well, the odds are they're not very good at writing either because, again, that's a skill that's disappearing.
Yeah.
And, you know, if we tried to often get pen and paper, reading the bad writing, that would be a challenge. So we're in this evolutionary period where a lot of problems, and unis need to be at the forefront of solving it. That's my view. We're agents for good. We need to be there. We need to support our students. Phones are here to stay, but how do we manage it in a sensible way? And how do we support our students have great networks, great friends, and the time of their life?
It's fascinating speaking with you, George. I'm so glad someone's written a book like this. It's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
George Williams' book is called Aiming Higher, University and Australia's Future. Today's conversation was made on the lands of the Gadigal people, produced by Alice Moldovan. Executive producer is Nicola Harrison. I'm Richard Feidler. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.